Hello, everyone. I am Catherine Spires. This is Smart Mouth. We are on Twitter at Smart Mouth Pod, on Instagram at Smart Mouth Podcast, and on Facebook in a secret group that you have to search for under Smart Mouth, two words. I'm also on Patreon, and as it happens, I just read an article on bellowcollective.com that said podcasters shouldn't be shy about asking people to contribute to their Patreon, that we have to get over ourselves. So please contribute to my Patreon. It's at patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast. For some behind the scenes context, I'm actually working on starting a Smart Mouth newsletter, and a little more cash to actually make it happen would be great. And so I might futz around with some of the reward tiers on Patreon to make that a little more clear. I might not. I don't know. Check it out at patreon.com/smartmouthpodcast. I got a question on Twitter in regards to the recent episode, the live episode up in Portland with Mohana Delshiki, which was all about tater tots. And Twitter user Butterfly Rachel wondered if Frito-Lay is the biggest buyer of potatoes in the United States. So I kind of suspected that McDonald's actually was. I emailed their media relations department to ask if that was true, and they didn't respond, which is so rude. But by doing a little internet digging, it seems that Frito-Lay North America buys 2 billion, with a B, pounds of potatoes every year. And McDonald's buys 3.4 billion, with a B, every year. That is a whole lot of spuds. So looks like it's McDonald's and then Frito-Lay and billions and billions, literally, of potatoes. I have a question for you all, my lovely listeners. Who would you like to hear as a guest on this show? There is a number that you can call into and leave a voicemail. It is 209-566-2253. If you want to call in and tell me who a dream guest would be and why, if you feel like saying that too, that would be great. Again, the number is 209-566-2253. For today's episode, my guest is Soleil Ho, and she is the brand new restaurant critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. And she's only about 5 years younger than me, but I'm going to grandma that up and go ahead and say that she has a good head on her shoulders. And I think that's going to serve her well at such a high profile job. And we talked about that a little bit. So on to the episode. Did you have a breakfast this morning?
For breakfast, I had a breakfast burrito at a local cafe and this coffee. I normally don't get anything for breakfast, but I was feeling very indulgent today.
It's sad in American that it felt indulgent to get breakfast.
Well, I mean, as a restaurant critic, my lunch and dinners are pretty high volume. So for breakfast, I usually do like a yogurt or like a banana.
Something simple,
yeah,
and reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Were you prepared for how much eating you were going to have to do?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm always like a very hungry person, and so that was totally fine. I'm very excited about that part.
Oh, that's good. That's good that you're excited. I know some people are like, I guess I'm investing in Tums now. We're just going to try our best.
I do take probiotics every day.
Oh, that seems like a smart idea.
Mm-hmm. Especially as someone who's lactose intolerant. And yet ignores that fact about mm-hmm. myself, mm-hmm. like, that's important.
I feel like a lot of people living in America who are lactose intolerant have to ignore that and just deal with consequences.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that something that you think about when you're ordering? You go to the restaurant. Do you go the three times for the Chronicle? Is mm-hmm. that?
It depends on the context.
Okay. So you're there. If you go to a restaurant more than once, you're like, well, at a certain point, I might have to order something with dairy in it.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, for tasting menus, I generally, and a lot of them, especially here, do not take substitutions, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
I respect that. So yeah, you just have to roll with it.
Everybody, I am up here in San Francisco this week interviewing Soleil Ho, who is the new San Francisco Chronicle restaurant critic. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm so excited.
You're like, well, I have meetings at 11 a.m., 1 p.m.
Yeah, Monday is a pretty heavy meeting day because a lot of restaurants are closed on Monday. And so I'm in the office.
Oh, that makes sense. You don't have to go into the office every day?
No.
Well, that's one perk.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you consider my meals out to be working hours, then it evens out.
Yeah. And that's something that I think maybe people outside of the industry wouldn't think of that. Because, of course, going to restaurants is something that is a pleasure for most people.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel ever like you have to sort of work to convince people that it's actually work?
Well, it's one of those things, right, that in our culture, we say that if you are doing what you love, it's not work. But it's fake. That's
right.
A fake idea.
Yes, I hate that so much.
Yeah. Because if you monetize anything, which a lot of millennials do because of necessity, it starts, you know, even the most pleasurable thing can feel like drudgery after a while.
Exactly.
And by pretending that it's not work, you're erasing your own labor and the commitments that you've made, you know, on your time and yourself and your, like, you know, mental health.
Oh my gosh, I love the way that you put that. Because I've never been able to think of an eloquent way beyond just like, I fucking hate it when people say do what you love. Because I really wish I hadn't. But you must. I mean, but then there's something about being a food critic that you must at a certain point have to love it / you're monetizing your really good palate, mm-hmm. which is part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
Let me back up. How long have you lived in San Francisco?
I've been here since mid-January.
So not even a month and a half? No, almost 2 months?
Almost 2 months, yeah.
Okay. How long before you moved here did you know you were moving here?
Gosh, I think I found out around Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So just a couple months.
Yeah. And then were you like to your husband, were you like, okay, we're doing this, let's go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, I was in the process of interviewing all that stuff for months before that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had time to kind of consider it. But I also didn't really ever think it was a sure thing mm-hmm. until Paolo, my editor, straight up called me and said, like, you've got the job, you know?
It's good not to count your chickens before they hatch.
Right. And so I didn't prepare all that much because I just thought if I prepared and they didn't give me the job, I would have been so devastated.
Yes. Yes. That makes a lot of sense. So where were you living before moving here?
Minneapolis.
Okay.
For a couple months.
Oh, no. So you've been moving a lot. And where were you before Minneapolis?
Puerto Vallarta, Mexico.
Okay. And how long were you there for?
2 years.
Okay, so you had like a second to breathe.
Yeah.
But not a long second.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting because up until I moved to Minneapolis in May of last year,
mm-hmm.
I was a restaurant worker and a writer and doing podcasts. And when I moved to the United States again, I thought, okay, I'm just going to focus on the creative work, right? The writing and the podcast making mm-hmm. and to see how that goes. Mm-hmm. And then I got this job and I was like, oh, all right, I guess we're just going.
Yeah, seriously, both feet in. Mm-hmm. So when you moved to Minneapolis, were you thinking that was more of a forever move and then this opportunity arose or what happened?
I was thinking it was a forever move. It's really close to where my husband's family lives mm-hmm. and also to my extended family. They live in Illinois. And so it just felt like a nice good base.
Yeah.
And if I could freelance and work for like New York or LA or San Francisco publications and make that kind of money
mm-hmm.
and pay Minneapolis rent, it would have been totally fine.
Smart.
That was the idea.
But then, of course, when you found out that they were hiring for this job, you got to put your application in, right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So a little history about the Chronicle, just one thing, because I think it's so funny. It was founded by teenagers. And they called it the Daily Dramatic Chronicle at first.
That's awesome.
Isn't that amazing? In 1865, the Daily Dramatic Chronicle. I don't know when they changed it, when they dropped the dramatic. But I thought it was like, yes, of course teenagers founded this place. So your background has both restaurant, as you mentioned, it has both restaurant and editorial mm-hmm. in it. Did you decide that you liked editorial more?
I think it was mainly a question of how did my body feel after a decade of working in restaurants,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so my back started hurting once I turned 30. All of a sudden I woke up and I was like, ah, what is this? And so, you know, there was that. And then just the feeling of, okay, I don't know if I can do this, be on my feet for 12 hours a day for the rest of my life. And I need to think about what is next, mm-hmm. right? And so I was, you know, and it always feels bad to like give something up that you've invested so much time into, but yeah. I think it was the right decision.
Yeah, yeah. Was part of the decision too, beyond the physical, were you thinking about like potential impact you could have, that more people would be reading your writing than eating your food?
Yeah, definitely. While I was, at least in the last year of working in restaurants, I was getting so many asks from people to do conferences, panels, podcast interviews. Just I was being commissioned to write things, and it was eating into my time that I had free, mm-hmm. you know, outside of the restaurant. And then I found that I was just working all the time, and then being asked to like fly out to such and such place and, you know, not cook. And so I thought, okay, like there's all this demand for what I'm saying, and like people are really curious about my takes on X, Y, and Z. And so, yeah, that seemed like a better use of time.
That makes sense. Is being a restaurant critic in particular a job that you felt like you always wanted?
No.
Did you even consider it? I mean, because your writing is traditionally, restaurant critics were really just about like, this is what's on the plate and right. this is how it tasted.
Right.
And we're moving into a place where it's more like, well, what else? What's mm-hmm. the context here? And that's the type of writing you clearly enjoy doing, but that wasn't always what restaurant criticism was.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I consumed a lot of that criticism as a kid and, you know, growing up, I loved reading restaurant criticism, and which is why I never really thought it was for me specifically until recently. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you see the rules, you understand like this is the genre. But then as you get older, you realize, oh, the genre can that has flexibility, right? You can shift things around. And writers before me have done that. You know, they've been a lot more literary, or they've played with form like Ruth Reichl did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that those are steps forward, and not even forward, but just in different directions that I think reveal the potentials of the genre. And I think the restrictions of criticism as a genre are really energetic, energizing to me, mm-hmm. because, you know, once you shift the frame a little bit, that seems like a big deal, you know?
Yeah.
It's fun in that way, because it blows people's minds. Like,
yeah.
Wait, you can say that in a review, or you can talk about this thing in a review? I'm like, yeah, it's not a big deal.
That's fantastic. Now, the person who had your job before you had it for 32 years, mm-hmm. which is a long run for any job. It's really a long run for a geographically small city to have one main restaurant critic, and especially in a town that's fairly obsessed with food, as towns go. So when you were in conversations with the Chronicle about taking this job, were you like, so can I do something different? Or are you looking for the same? Did that come up at all?
Sort of. But I knew from the beginning when they called me, when Paolo, the editor, called me, that they wouldn't have called me if they didn't want something different.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Like, I'm pretty transparent about what I'm about. I think very few people could look at my body of work and come away with a different, you know, idea of what I'm about mm-hmm. than what is clearly on the page
right.
and, you know, in the audio. And so I think if they called me, then they obviously know what they want.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense. So did they reach out to you initially?
Sort of. I mean, I did put in an application.
Got it.
But it was a very no frills sort of like, you check the boxes, like, are you a citizen? Have you committed a felony? Upload your LinkedIn, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. It was pretty chill.
Pretty easy from the start. And so one of the things that you talk about too, there's all this conversation right now about the elitism of media, mm-hmm. and sometimes that's a silly conversation and sometimes it makes sense. And I think that in one of the places it makes sense is lifestyle journalism, because I guess when lifestyle journalism started, it was for at least the middle class. But I don't think that that's who you're necessarily, or you're not only speaking to a certain subsegment of people.
Right. Yeah. You know, when you think about leisure history, mm-hmm. it's very much mired in like the idea that, oh, now we aren't working all the time in fields or toiling in factories. We have time. And so, and, you know, that's a story in Europe. But especially when you think about ancient Japan, for instance, you know, the leisure classes, the aristocracy spent a lot of time on aesthetics and sensory games, like perfume games, right? Where they would smell a perfume and guess like what the components of it were.
Oh, interesting.
For fun. Okay. And so I think about that a lot with regards to like what I do and uh-huh. what, you know, we do in the food media. That is leisure. You know, it is privileged.
Yeah. Yeah. Having the time to be like, ooh, I wonder what spices are in this.
Right.
Even, yeah, having the bandwidth to care.
Right. Yeah. And it's not a strict binary, right? Like you can appreciate components in a curry regardless of your income mm-hmm. level. But like to actually have to sit down and spend time writing about it mm-hmm. is very different.
Yeah. Yeah.
At the same time, I would say that I am writing for a segment of people, I think, and this reflects my story too, where we grew up sort of middle class, right? Or even like, yeah, just in the middle class. And then as time went on, as we came of age, the middle class has shrunk, right? Mm-hmm. Dramatically. And our access to, you know, the way we grew up has shrunk dramatically. And so, you know, I was on food stamps. Like as a graduate student, I, you know, made very little money for most of my adult life. Yeah. And so, you know, where do I hang out in this, right?
That is so interesting because that is also, I feel like, my life story. And I never considered like the bigger, I guess I was being narcissistic. I was like, oh, this is me. But you're saying that like our whole generation is, I mean, because we talk about like the shrinking middle class and all this stuff, but you were actually thinking about how it affected you and the people that you're writing for. Mm-hmm. That's so fascinating.
Yeah, just like the different relationship to affordability, right?
Yeah.
But you still care about the stuff. You grew up like interested in good food or like culture, good music, but you can't afford it in the yeah. same degree, which I think is why a lot of these like bigger restaurants or restaurant groups are opening fast casual places. And so that's also a story mm-hmm. that tracks with like these larger scale economic trends. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's all very interesting.
That is very fascinating. Are you going to be doing writing that isn't technically restaurant criticism, like restaurant reviews?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you'll have more space to explore that kind of stuff as well.
Yep.
Interesting. Are you on like a schedule of how many articles you have to write per week or anything like that?
Generally, we're figuring it out. But okay. to start, I'm doing one review a week and mm-hmm. then hopefully one podcast a week. Mm-hmm. And they'll be shorter and less like they won't be huge projects, but there'll be some content there and the newsletter. And so the newsletter's got some good space, but there's also other buckets that I could fill
yeah.
as well. I mean, like I was just in a pitch meeting and I had a bunch of ideas and they were like, oh, yeah, you should write that and that and that. And I was like, OK, cool.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I hope you have time to do it. Don't overwork yourself.
Thank you.
You're probably just eager right now, right? Mm.
Yeah. But a lot of these are also like larger scale, like long term projects. Right. So they're easier to space out.
So is the Chronicle paying you OK? Because yeah. this has been another problem in food media.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that they're like making an effort to have their people not have to take free meals to do the job?
Yeah, they are. And this is the first job that I've had that has benefits. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know what to do with that. I was like, wait, what's an HSA? I was like looking it up this weekend, like, oh my God, I could pay for like this and go to the doctor outside of Mexico. Like, this is really interesting. And, you know, learning about the things that, I don't know, I considered this at first my millennial breakout job. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
Tell me more.
Like, I've been living paycheck to paycheck my entire adult life. Mm-hmm. And I don't have savings. And
right there with you. And I'm 5 years older than you, so.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. And I think this will be the first job that will enable me to have any kind of savings.
That's amazing. Which means that they're paying you okay for San Francisco, too. Yeah. Not like okay for Minneapolis.
Yeah. I mean, it's not tech money, but like right. that's also, you know, blood money, so.
Yeah. You know, I was born in San Francisco and my mom and I driving over to the offices, she was reminiscing about riding her bike down streets that would be too scary to now because there's too many cars and that kind of stuff.
I mean, someone just died. Yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm.
On 6th and Howard.
Man, it's so different. And I worry about like the different mindsets. And for instance, the last fortune cooking factory in San Francisco proper, and it's the last place that hand makes the fortune cookies. Their rent last month, I think, went from $1,500 a month to $5,000 a month.
Right.
Which kills me because I feel like as humans, we don't need to be making the most possible money at all times. And if you've got something that like is not an official landmark, but says so much about the soul of the city and you try and push them out to get a few thousand extra bucks a month, I hate that. And I hate that that might be a symptom of what San Francisco is right now.
Yeah. Yeah. there is a sense of, like, I guess, they're combating senses of what the greater good entails,
yeah.
right? Is the greater good more money,
mm-hmm.
Having more eyeballs on work or having more users engage with your app? Or is the greater good something less profitable?
Yeah.
You know, and those things are clashing a lot here.
I guess it has to be a judgment call.
Yeah.
What would you do? Would you keep the fortune cookie factory?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Agreed, obviously. So I briefly talked about your predecessor, Michael Bauer. Do you feel any like internal need or external pressure to be some sort of reaction, do something different than what he did?
There's a lot of external pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Not from my editors or anyone on staff, but from readers.
Yeah.
His name is mentioned a lot in the correspondence that I receive from readers. And I just, you know, I prefer not to react to that,
mm-hmm.
you know, specifically, because he's just a different person.
Right.
You know, he started the job literally before I was born, which humbles me a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
it's also wild because as millennials, we staying in one job your entire career isn't what we know.
Right. Yeah.
He was here for a long time for sure. And do you... You had mentioned something. You started your tenure here by dropping 5 reviews at once,
mm-hmm.
and then also an article about what you want to do
right.
as the restaurant critic,
mm-hmm.
Which I thought was such a cool move because people got to see sort of more of a breadth of your work. And I'm sure that that's what you all intended to do
mm-hmm.
from inside the office. When you wrote the Chez Panisse review, which wasn't glowing, where you're like, "Well, here we go."
A little bit. You know, we were really careful about it and trying to make sure that it was airtight and that I had a lot of, you know, backup as far as what I wrote about and just, you know, theoretically and philosophically. At the same time, they'd already had their Michelin star removed.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not the first person, you know, to have any sort of thoughts about Chez Panisse that were not glowing.
Yeah.
I think some people forgot that part.
Yes.
But, you know, it ended up being really popular. Because I think it had – the sense I'm getting, because I'm a newcomer, is that it was sort of not okay to publicly say that you didn't enjoy your experience there.
Uh-huh.
And so I got a lot of emails and correspondence from people who were just like, oh, my God, thank you for opening the floodgates because I've been saying this whole time. And, you know, like, that's always funny.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And it's also always frustrating that the people who support you will only email you privately and the people who are angry at you will say so publicly.
I mean, I think it's been a mix of both for me.
Okay, that's yeah. good. That's good. I do think that a thing that's harder is you are a individual woman with a name versus something like Michelin, which is anonymous. So if people don't like what you say, they can come for you personally. And people do get really personal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's horrible.
Yeah.
Do you have to, like, go to weekly therapy? Like, did they recommend that you do that?
I mean, I'm still shopping for a therapist. I'm still new. And, you know, that's part of the process of coming to a new place.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something really isolating about hate mail in particular, because no one else can deal with it for you.
Right.
You know, like, how do you process it and how do you respond to it? Because you still internalize a little bit of it because you have to read it to find out if it's hate mail even.
Mm-hmm.
And then... You know, again, like if you're flooded with all of that, what do you do or how do you respond? Because, you know, I was just written about in the Washington Post and, you know, my like identity markers were put in the headline. And so that's what a lot of people read
yeah.
and stop reading.
Just the headline, right.
And so I've gotten correspondence about like, you know, why are you making a big deal about you being queer? I'm like, I don't.
Yeah.
You know, it's just in the headline.
Right.
But, you know, there are a lot of people who were very vocal about that part, too, which felt really personal. Like, I'm not going to go back in the closet because you're mad at me, you know? So there's that, too, where it's complicated. I try not to let it get to me because I grew up on the internet. Mm-hmm. And I have also been a troll when I was a child.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely. And not in this very lazy way that modern day trolls comport themselves. Like, I was an absurdist troll.
Okay.
I wasn't racist or sexist or homophobic. I would, you know, spam picnic baskets or like penises at people and, you know, things like that that were like silly. And so there's nothing these people can say to me that's worse than what I've, you know, seen or done on the internet
that's
as
really
a child.
Funny. Interesting. But difference, you did it as a child, and there are adults who seem to make it their life's work to be mean to people on the internet.
Yeah, they're not very good at it, though.
I feel like you must be a stronger person than me, because not only do you have a higher profile, but you're also clearly chiller about it than I am. I get hurt so easily. I feel like the, well, they're clearly idiots thing is so much easier said than done.
Yeah, no, I feel you. It's not your fault, though.
I know.
Because, I mean, as a species, right, the internet is so confusing. You're not supposed to deal with more than maybe 200 people's emotions at once, right? Like, that's the optimal size for, like, a village,
yeah,
a community. But we're exposed to, you know, potentially millions of people through our work and just being online who are not in our proximity. And your brain just cannot handle that.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. Did you come up with that or did someone tell you that?
I did a lot of research into internet cultures when I was in high school. Yeah, so I've always been really interested in that part too, and like the idea of the collapsing of context with social media as well. Just how, you know, in a certain context, my work or myself makes sense with like my community, but when it's taken out of that context, it can be read in bad faith in a lot of different ways. Like when you think about people who've gone viral for doing things, or like they post pictures of them doing other things, like the woman who gave the finger at this like Arlington National Cemetery, right?
Right.
That was a particular context that she was operating in. But then once it escaped that context, you know, there was all sorts of readings and harassment that she received because they didn't understand like where she was coming from or what she was doing.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That is such a good way of looking at it, and a fascinating point that I had never considered, which is like also another reason why you're good at this job, because you're like, no, I understand the way the internet works.
Yeah,
I'll be fine. So one of your articles where you were talking about, it was not the review, it was the piece where you said, this is what I want to do as a restaurant critic. These are words I don't want to use, that sort of thing. You said that you wouldn't be hobnobbing with people in the restaurant world. Okay, so this is something that I think is maybe a lot of people think that restaurant critics are not very good friends with chefs. And in my experience working with restaurant critics, that is not the case. So are you really going to have no chef friends in San Francisco?
Oh, no, I already do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what does no hobnobbing mean in that context?
It means that I won't socialize publicly, or I won't go to their like industry parties.
Okay.
There are sorts of interesting and like weird lines that I have to cross. Like I have to do events sometimes, right? And sometimes that means I'm moderating a panel of chefs. Or, you know, restaurant people. And that's kind of keeping it professional publicly.
Yeah.
At the same time, like, I do talk to my friends.
Right.
You know, and so, but I do make it clear to them that my professional life will not intersect with my personal life. And so they have projects, right, that are interesting to me professionally. And I will evaluate those projects fairly. And I've been very clear about that, and they totally understand. You know, if they open a restaurant and I go and I don't love it, then I'm going to say that. And
don't you think in practice that might mean the end of the friendship?
I mean, if that is the end of the friendship, they weren't very good friends with me either way, right?
Yeah.
You want to tell your friends there's spinach in their teeth because you care about them.
Yes. Okay, when you put it that way, sure. You're not anonymous.
Right.
Even though you're the restaurant critic.
Right.
And this actually kind of goes back to your understanding of the internet. You were like, my picture is already out there.
Right.
Do you think that people are having a hard time with that?
I don't think so. I think I've explained it pretty clearly in that the decision was made for me.
Oh, it was.
I just, the internet.
Oh, by the internet, right?
Yeah.
Right. Gotcha.
You know, because I have done the projects that I've done, Racist Sandwich and my writing, and I've made appearances, just panel discussions, whatever. My pictures are out there. You know, they have been in magazines and newspapers and all of that stuff. And so it's impossible. Like, what am I supposed to do?
If it were a different world, would you have wanted to be anonymous?
If it were? No, I don't think so. Because there's so much power, especially when I think about my podcast project, right? There was so much power in being a visible person of color, visible woman of color, doing a podcast in, you know, the podcast world is a very white male place.
Yeah.
And, you know, putting myself out there was a political project.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess when you say a different world, if we weren't living in like a white supremacist like society, then like maybe that wouldn't have been a big deal. And maybe I would have been anonymous, but there was power in that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I got to figure that you're probably inspirational to some of the baby millennials too. Do you ever think about that?
I do. I've gotten interviewed before for school projects, or I've talked to classes, and it's really strange.
Yeah.
Like I'll be interviewed by students and they're just like trembling as they talk to me. I'm like, oh, you sweet angel.
That's horrible.
Yeah. And they're like, you're my hero. I'm like, oh, okay. That's really sweet. You know,
that is, that's really nice. So when you have internet trolls, randoms, what about when someone like Mimi Sheraton says something mean about you? Because she's an old guard restaurant critic and she clearly didn't get what you were about.
I was so happy. She noticed me.
You are so emotionally strong. I can't deal with it. That is your takeaway. That would have ruined. Well, it wouldn't have ruined me for a couple of reasons, but it would have been really hard for me.
Mm. No, I was just thrilled. I was like, wow, I'm of note to Mimi Sheraton. That's so amazing.
That is fantastic. I applaud you for doing. The thing that kind of killed me is that she was talking about you in particular as if it were you were the one running the printing press and you decided to drop 5 reviews at once. I was like, she has editors.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, that's why it's hard to take it seriously, like as a personal thing. Like, okay, you know how the newspaper works. Maybe. Right. It's okay. But she just like wanted so much to say something about me, which made me so happy. Like, you want, yeah, you have a take on me. This is great.
Oh my gosh, I love it. I love that point of view. Have you seen anything since you moved to San Francisco that's new to you food-wise?
Hmm. Burmese food.
Oh, yeah?
Of course, there's so many Burmese restaurants here and Burmese people. And, of course, Burma Superstar is a big deal out here. You know, that's one of the highlights of the food scene. And so having tea leaf salad for the first time was just wonderful. And kind of seeing how Burmese cuisine intersects with, like, all of these different cultures around Burma and, you know, the textures of the salads that they make are so great because I hate salad. And so that was just so welcome to me.
Oh, so it's a salad that you actually like.
Yes.
I've heard you say that you hate lettuce, you hate green bell peppers, but you're not just saying that you hate salad just overall?
No. So lettuce salad is difficult because there's that whole, you know, if you leave a lettuce salad dressed for too long, it gets really soggy, yeah, which I hate so much. And as a cook, I spent a lot of time sorting through spring greens like mesclun and getting all those super like rotty leaves out of the giant like pile.
Yeah.
And so I have that visceral memory of that. And the smell just makes me so like, ugh.
Yeah.
It's really unpleasant to me because it brings me back to that. Just sorting through all of that and then serving it like, oh God, you know, if they only knew.
Are those your only two food aversions?
I think so. Not, well, yeah. And mainly it's not because I won't eat them, because I will eat that stuff, of course. And I eat a lot of both of those things. It's more just, it feels like a waste of time.
That's funny. Do you have like a favorite ingredient? Just in general. I know that asking if you have a favorite food is too hard, but is there something that you're always like, yes?
Dried seafood.
Dried seafood. Okay. Like, so in any preparation, if you see it on the menu, you're like, let me try that.
Yeah.
What'd you do with that?
Yeah. One of my favorite snacks when I was a kid was dried cuttlefish, almost like a jerky. And it had like a sprinkling of MSG on it and sugar and salt. And sometimes if you were lucky, it was spicy as well. It's just one of my favorite things in the world.
That's awesome. That's a good one. And San Francisco is a good city to find dried seafood snacks. And you've been exploring like the suburbs and the smaller cities on the peninsula and that sort of thing, right? And have you been finding interesting food there?
Yeah. A lot of really, really fascinating pockets of communities there. I went on a taco crawl of Redwood City and Menlo Park, and that was really fascinating. I didn't realize how many taquerias were out there. That was awesome. And then San Mateo was really, really interesting as well. Just the stretch. There's a main stretch there in the town where Kenji Lopez Alt's restaurant is, Worst Hall. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of other places there that are smaller and also doing fascinating things. There was a sushi bar out there that people were lined up in front of before they opened. So, like, that was intriguing.
Did you end up eating there?
No. I didn't. We ended up going to Chef Zhao Bistro, mm-hmm. which is also in San Mateo. I had these really great bean jelly noodles there that were just like cold and floppy and just, yeah, delicious and drenched in chili oil.
Nice. So you like spicy food is what I'm gathering.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have you eaten anywhere not for work, or are you still so new that everything is potentially for work?
Everything's potentially for work. Let's see. I'm trying to think of something else. You know, everything is just a process of discovery for me. And so it all adds up to my bigger picture of what to write about and how to compare things and experiences. You know, being able to compare, let's say, Chez Panisse to Quoi de Bennu to Delfina, you know, like all of that is part of the bigger picture. And so I'm trying to think of, I did go to In-N-Out yesterday.
Was that your first In-N-Out experience?
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Sure, yeah.
Is it the one in Fisherman's Wharf that you went to? So the only one in San Francisco proper.
Yes.
Did you go there because you were in the area and hungry, or were you like, today is In-N-Out day?
Today was In-N-Out day.
Okay.
I had planned it ahead like a week before.
Okay.
It was a big deal.
Who did you go with?
I went with Catherine Hamilton, who is the food critic for the East Bay Express.
Oh, okay, cool.
So it was sort of like a no fire zone, you know?
Uh-huh. and presumably she had been there before.
Yes.
So what did you order?
I ordered, because it was really funny, right? Because I posted about it on Twitter and then I got so many responses from people like, oh, you should order it this way, blah, 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 animal style, blah, whatever. But I wanted to get it pure, you know? And so I got a double-double and just fries and a Coke.
All right. How did you get your onions on the double-double?
They were raw.
Okay. So you didn't even say
I didn't customize anything.
Okay.
Because I just needed a baseline.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. How did you feel about it?
The fries were awful.
Sure.
The burger was just the ideal burger for me, like a fast food burger. It hit all of the flavor notes that I expected and wanted, from the like really weak bun to the, you know, the commingling of like the beef and the cheese and the Coca-Cola. That was like perfect. Just the way it disintegrates in your hands, that was also perfect.
This is so interesting because it sounds like you're really denigrating it, but you liked it for what it is.
Right.
Even though it's lettuce heavy?
Well, the lettuce was hard. So I pulled out the soggy ones. But
okay. Yeah. And of course, I had to instantly agree with you about the fries because they are famously bad. The reasons for being bad, I think, are actually kind of respectable. It's because they cut them up in-house and just fry them once. Instead of,
I don't respect that.
You don't even respect like the intent behind it?
No.
Why?
I think if you do things wrong and make it something that you're proud of, that doesn't make any sense, you know, because there's a reason why you blanch your fries, even if you make them in-house. And I've been in charge of restaurants where we would make the French fries in-house every day, but you blanch them first, and that way they're crispier and fluffier on the inside.
I wonder if In-N-Out will ever move to making better French fries.
I doubt it.
It almost seems like the battle about whether they're the best or the worst, no in between, is actually almost part of their identity now.
Yeah, I don't know. They're so mysterious, you know, from the Bible verse stuff. Yeah. And then they just seem very committed to their certain way of doing things. So I doubt they'll shift.
No, that's actually a good point. The only thing is that they've expanded, but that's because they made deals with more cattle ranches. Mm-hmm. So with this new owner, who's a billionaire about your age, who's a race car driver.
Nice.
She's an interesting woman herself. So are you going to go back to In-N-Out and customize it in the way that people have recommended?
I think so. I'll have to like steel myself because I can only handle like one cheeseburger, fast food cheeseburger, like a month.
Okay, that's you know? Fair.
For my health, but
yeah,
I think next time I'll try animal style, I
sure.
guess.
Uh-huh. The burger and the fries?
Should I do both? That seems like a lot of mayonnaise.
Maybe not in once. Have them separately and see if you liked them. Get a burger animal style and then ask for the fries well done.
Oh, no. I tried that too.
Oh, you didn't like that either?
It was awful. It's just like harder,
yeah.
But still styrofoamy.
I know. I mean, I think you're right.
It's, you know, it's like, what is it? Putting lipstick on a pig.
Yeah.
Just, okay.
Yeah, that's right. Although I do also always get a root beer float there.
Mm.
That's my off menu order item. You said that you like Swan Oyster Depot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you managed to get in there. Every Yelp review on there is like, well, we waited in line for 3 hours. And I'm like, I'm out. That's too much. Did you wait in line for 3 hours?
No, 1 hour.
Even that I can't get into.
I brought a book. But it's fascinating. I really, you know, I'm really interested in waiting in lines too and like what that means for us.
Well, then you moved to a good city.
Right. Because I was just in Tokyo this past fall,
mm-hmm.
and I waited in line for 2 hours to go to a ramen shop
okay.
that had, I think, one Michelin star,
because mm-hmm.
I was interested in like what that means. And my husband was not having it. He was so mad. And so I sent him off to like 7-Eleven to get snacks for himself because his blood sugar gets low and then he gets crabby. So, yeah. You know, that's a whole different thing. But when you wait in line, there's some really interesting like human dynamics that come out.
Yeah.
And I really want to write about that. Just watching people run out of things to talk about is so amazing.
Oh my gosh.
Right? Because yeah. they're coworkers or they're lovers or family members. And then what?
Yeah.
And people, especially in America, have a really hard time being quiet with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a difference that I noticed versus Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
where people were just, you know, next to each other silently for 2 hours. And I didn't sense any tension there.
How are you going to do this story? Are you going to tap people on the shoulder after you've noticed them stop talking?
No. I am an observer mostly. Uh-huh. I love watching people uh-huh. and thinking about them and just wondering what's going on. So I usually try not to intervene too much. It's like a prime directive thing.
Interesting. Hey, have you been to a dim sum restaurant? I think it's called Dragon Bows.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been there yet?
Mm-hmm.
Did you like it?
I did. Yeah.
Is that a place that we should go?
I My mom think and I? So. let me think. It is kind of overwhelming
uh-huh.
because there's so many things on the menu. But I would say don't order the Five Guys Xiaolongbao, the one with all the colors.
Yeah, I saw that. And that kind of upset me. So you get like a little platter, like a deviled egg dish. And in each hole, there's a different colored Xiaolongbao.
Mm-hmm.
That seems way too gimmicky.
Yeah. I mean, the good thing is they use natural colorings.
Okay.
So it's not, you know, like Easter eggs or anything like that. But mm-hmm. The flavors aren't really, they don't translate too well. So just get the standard. The standard's really good.
Okay. That's good to know. Are there any other good dim sum places here that you've been to yet?
Let's see. I really enjoyed Hong Kong East Ocean Seafood.
Mm-hmm.
That's out in Emeryville, though.
Okay. This is good. Because my parents lived in San Francisco in the early 80s and I was born here. And that's the frame of reference for us is dim sum when San Francisco was like the main place to get it mm-hmm. in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So, like, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you.
And talking with me today. How can people sign up for your new newsletter?
If you go to sfchronicle.com/newsletters, you can find it. It's called Bite Curious. And you can just sign up through there. You can also sign up for the other newsletters if you're interested. There's a lot.
Yeah, that seems like a good idea. And where should people follow you on social media?
On Twitter, I am at H-O-O-L-E-I-L because H-O-L-E-I-L was taken, but was my nickname in college with one friend. and then on Instagram, I'm just Soleil_ho.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're going to San Francisco.